I've run multiple marathons back to back on Mexican food and eaten far too much and seen it all again. You know, I've made the mistakes on how to overfuel, underfuel, eat the right things, not eat the right things, try a plant-based diet, try full carbs, try loads of gels, try loads of fats, taken it to the high altitude mountains and tried to figure out the right and wrong things to do.
Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking with Ben Turner on extreme nutrition for extreme conditions. So what I wanted to do in the conversation is examine some of the principles of nutrition that are required for extreme conditions and indeed long distance running. So we examine whether ratios are helpful, so ratios of carbs, proteins and fats. We look at the frequency and quality of food. We're also going to look at calories required for multi-day events, and also the requirement for electrolytes. We're going to examine carb strategies and much more. So to do this, I have Ben Turner with me. Ben served in the British military, or indeed the British Army, for 7 years before dedicating himself to extreme endurance challenges. So these consisted of ultramarathons with a 25-kilogram rucksack, the Glencoe Sky Race, the Three Peaks Rope Climb, the 3,373-kilometer solo bike packing around Iceland, and last but not least, 16 marathons in 16 days in 16 national parks around the UK. So now, with a drive towards world skyrunning and enduro mountain bike races, Ben pairs his passion with knowledge through his business, The Adventure Coach. So as an NMU nutritionist, endurance coach, mountaineer instructor, and CB practitioner, Ben empowers people to live their most adventurous life, coaching people to feel competent, confident, and clear on how to affect positive and adventurous change in their lives. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Very much. What a wonderful welcome.
Ben, I just want to, before we actually even kick off with any of the questions I had in mind to ask you, I actually want to ask you what indeed skyrunning or world skyrunning actually is.
Well, I feel like, so skyrunning in its essence is trail running in really, really sharp mountains. So the whole idea of skyrunning was just like, it's like extreme trail running. It's a European discipline that has kind of taken off a little bit here in the UK. We don't have a huge amount of skyrunning potential here in the UK. There are some, absolutely. But ultimately, find some really pointy ridges, some really high mountains, and find a route up there and run them. So, for example, the Glencoe Sky Race, that is one on the World Skyrunning Series. The Ultra Trail Snowdonia, which I'm doing next year, is another on the Skyrunning World Series as well. And these are, you know, we're finding routes up really, really sharp mountains. So, for example, the Glencoe Sky Race is going up a curved ridge along the Anakiga, along the Bijian Nambian. Some of the races that I want to do next year, there's one that literally goes up the Matterhorn. There are a few in Italy, which look really exciting. And there's some very exciting ones that go up to the Aiguille Rouge in Chamonix as well. So find very pointy mountains and run up them. Essentially, anything that you see Kilian Jornet doing nowadays, that seems to be where it's at.
Fantastic, fantastic. And Ben, I wonder if we could just start very much at the start and ask you to speak to why you got into nutrition in the first place, and indeed what the military taught you about nutrition.
That's an interesting question. So I got into nutrition because I was a very naive young soldier who was pretty much doing anything to get super jacked, like most soldiers do. I failed at getting super jacked, but I found myself, you know, going down the internet and just seeing like, oh, right, what else do I need to do here? And looking at people like Jim Stepani and people who have got like massive supplement ranges. And this guy had doctor in his name, so clearly it's the right thing. So I'm thinking, oh, I must do all of that and start eating cottage cheese and pineapple and going to the gym and doing all these things and having like sherbet sticks in between workouts and things. Yes, I literally did all of that. And I realized the army teach you nothing about nutrition. I mean, you get given ration packs, that's good. You get given food on camp, that's good. But you don't get taught nutrition per se as part of your physical training. And I can kind of see why you wouldn't. But it does open up the area for a lot of trying to figure out for yourself what's going on. And that was a very long journey for me. It takes me a long time to learn stuff, but I made a lot of mistakes and learned a lot for myself, as we may end up talking out as we go through this podcast. But what drew me to actually learning about nutrition and getting qualified when I went through MNU, so to become an evidence-based nutritionist, was to actually figure out, well, I knew that there were certain things that were wrong. I knew there were certain biases that were just, they just didn't seem right. You know, when people say very sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not extremist points of views, but essentially they'll say that this is the one thing that is the exact thing we should be doing, and this is the secret. And I'm thinking, really? I'm not entirely sure. And I kind of figured, I guess I cultivated a bit of a critical thinking mindset around that. So I did MNU. And that completely opened my eyes, because I literally went into that. And the first thing they asked me, and I remember, was, you know, comment below on this thread, you know, what you feel like your main biases are. And I'm like, well, you know, saturated fat is bad. And, you know, the vegan diet is obviously the most healthy diet because it's got the most plants. That's kind of where I'm at. I think, oh, and, you know, carbs are probably bad. And you're thinking, right, actually, when you look back on that, you think, oh, I think I was wrong on all three counts. And then when you learn, when I went through MNU and I really learned about it, well, not only did I learn actually about nutrition, but also how to read research, how to interpret things, how to explore that critical thinking mindset more to problem solve. Because the beautiful thing about nutrition is nobody will ever know 100% about nutrition. It's wonderful. There's no one size fits all approach for every single person. And that's what I find working with clients now. It's wonderful because every single person is ever so slightly different. So it forces you to think about things. It forces you to dive into the details, and it forces you to challenge not only your own biases, but everyone else's biases as well. And you just, you end up on a very exciting journey. So nutrition for me was a natural progression, because I had to build on, you know, personal training qualifications and PTI qualifications that don't really teach you that much apart from like macro splits and stuff. So the journey into evidence-based nutrition was a natural one, and it's a fascinating one. Unfortunately, I'd say maybe the military don't teach you that much, but it was a good thing to learn on the outside and put into practice today.
So I would massively advocate that around this critical thinking and being able to judge the hierarchy of research as well, and what's true and what might be a meta truth, but a more specific or generalized truth, which is evidence based, and like you said, being able to read a study and then get the revelation that actually not all studies lead to the truth. And, you know, so that in itself is kind of like a revelation in itself. But could I just, before we go into the minutiae and maybe some of the nuances of nutrition and dieting, could I get you to speak to some of the fundamental principles of nutrition that you advocate and live by?
So that's an interesting question. And I feel like, from what I've learned, to put this into practice, I've been coaching people now since 2019. So what are we on now? About four, nearly 5 years. And there are certain things I've come to understand. People will overcomplicate things. Social media will overcomplicate things because sex sells, you know, big fancy words sell. There are people who will run around in their lab coats and, you know, with no top on, and they'll have rippling abs, and they'll say, hey, don't eat kale. Kale is bad. And it's full of these big words and stuff. And it all boils down to the very unsexy, boring truth of, you've got to keep it simple. Because nutrition is so often vastly overcomplicated that actually the vast majority of people, if not everybody listening to this podcast now, will know some decent, nutritionally beneficial things to do. We know that we want to eat fruit and vegetables. We may know that protein is very good. We know that we want to be hydrated. We know that we need to manage our sleep and our stress. Like, if we can simplify things, you're going to see maximum benefit. Because what we're doing there, if we look at our own version of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we're concentrating on the bottom. We're keeping things super simple, and we're not focusing on the tip of the wedge, which is where I think a lot of the clickbaity stuff focuses. I guess another one is, outside of clinical conditions, from my experience, the vast majority of people whom I have met who want to improve their nutrition will want to do one of three things. And again, this is outside of clinical conditions. Number one is, you're looking for weight loss. Number two is, you're looking for sporting performance of whatever sense. Or the other side is, you are looking for a healthier way of eating, but within a weight maintenance perspective. So one is weight loss, one is weight maintaining, and one is sports performance. You're going to fit into one of those three things, notwithstanding clinical conditions. And I think, first and foremost, when it comes to looking at how to adapt your nutrition, figure out what camp you're in first. Don't look at weight loss and healthy eating and performance all at once. Do one at a time, because everything else will fall into place as you're actioning one specific area, much like training, you know, being specific. Specific adaptation to impose demand in our physical training, same thing with our nutrition. And I feel like number three kind of links to keeping it simple. There are no good or bad foods. You have unconditional permission to eat anything you want. The moment we start saying, and this, I don't want this to sound super sort of hippie and out there and far-fetched, but the moment we start to say there are good and there are bad foods, you are going to inadvertently adapt your psychology to those foods. Now, you could be listening to this with the most solid head in the world, and you are completely level-headed and you are cool. And you're listening to that being like, I don't know what you're talking about, Ben. You know, I know there's no good or bad foods. It doesn't affect me. But there might be some people who are listening to this being like, yeah, but what about carbs? What about bread? What about sugar? What about aspartame? What about sweeteners? What about this, that, and the other? What about fats? What about this? It's like, there aren't good or bad foods, but there are foods that are more nutritionally functional, more nutritionally beneficial than others. You can still go out on a Saturday morning and have, you know, an oat milk dirty chai with an almond croissant, because that makes your life feel good. It doesn't have to always be super, super strict and super, super black and white. And then I feel like the fourth one is going back to that kind of nutritional version of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Things like supplements, or what we would call ergogenic aids, things that you're going to be doing external to your diet, these are tip of the wedge. These are the things that we need to be focusing on right at the end, once we've got all of that other stuff sorted. You know, you want to address the fundamentals at the base of that pyramid, because A, that's where you're going to see maximum benefit, and B, it's a bit like, I like to use analogies, which you might find through this podcast. It's a bit like the analogy of if you and I were to go and build a house together. Well, if we just dive straight in, went to Magnet and started designing our kitchen, well, that's not putting trenches in the ground, filling them with concrete and hardcore and stuff. It's not putting bricks on top of that. That's not building the walls for house. The fundamentals of nutrition are doing the trenches, filling them with concrete, forming foundations. And then the time will come that we can go and, you know, design a kitchen, and it'd be an amazing thing. But you want to be keeping it simple. You want to figure out what camp you're in. Understand that there are no good or bad foods, just ones that are more nutritionally beneficial. And understanding that there's a hierarchy here that we need to be addressing and following, and not always addressing the tip of the wedge. So I feel like I love the term that of principles there are few, methods there are a million, then some principles there are few. The person who can grasp the principles can make their own methods, which I feel like is a Tennyson quote. I can't quite remember. But again, understanding those principles means that you can make your own methods. What I find a lot of people do at the moment, and a lot of clickbaity things, and unfortunately very famous people on social media, is they will create a method without really understanding the principles behind it, or rather not really sharing the principles behind it, and then lulling you into a sense of security that you need to follow that particular method, like intermittent fasting, like Slimming World, like Juice Plus, like carnivore, like keto. These are all methods that aren't sharing the principles with you. But as soon as you grasp the principles, which are, and I'll say it right now, relatively simple, but not always easy to implement. Once you've got a grasp of those, you make your own methods. Because nutrition in its essence is a relatively simple thing to understand for what it is that you're looking for, but not always easy for us all to implement.
I think that's extremely informative, and it implies actually that you've put some thought into exactly, like you said, making food serve you, but also the methods of indeed the way you interact with nutrition and with food, and habits over time, actually. So the habitual practices over time, but having and stewarding a healthy mindset in regards to nutrition. So in that, you have actually mentioned some of these already, Ben, around some of the common traps and or pitfalls that people fall into. And I think one of the most powerful ones you've just denoted is not knowing the why. And actually, if you haven't got the why, the who and the how often fall to the wayside quite quickly, because unless you have the focus and the reason or the rationale behind the focus, the methodology falls away. Could you speak to some of these? So you've mentioned that one, and I think that's powerful, because I think that allows us to reframe that cognitive mindset. Could you speak to some of the other pitfalls that people fall into?
Yeah, and I think I want to address pitfalls respectfully. You know, people who are listening to here, I'm probably going to touch on some nerves here. And I'm not saying this to target anyone and say that you're inherently wrong. I'm saying that this is the problem with the nutrition industry. It's so under-regulated that people do find themselves falling into these pitfalls rather unknowingly. And it might be the point at which, you know, it seems like the negative effects of this are a lot on your mind, or, you know, you're starting to lose progress in what it is you're trying to do, that you then understand, actually, I'm in one of these diet traps or these pitfalls. And I feel like the number one thing is people trying to find the number one fix, finding that one fix that will do that one thing. If I do one thing, everything is fixed. And I'm going to say it relatively bluntly, I think it's because we've become inherently lazy in trying to figure out the overarching causation of what it is that we're trying to do. So, for example, trying to find the one fix. I'm going to throw out some brand names there. Maybe it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm not sure. That, like, Athletic Greens, having a greens powder every single day. Is that the one fix? It's definitely sold as the one fix because you look at their marketing, but it isn't. If you eat like crap for the rest of the day, doesn't matter how many green shakes you have in that day, your overall diet is very poor. Having a protein bar as a snack, you know, great, you can have a grenade bar. They're great. I do like them, really do. But if the rest of your diet is really poor, devoid of fiber and vegetables and fruits and variety and joy in food as well, you're going to be fighting a losing battle. And that plays into, when we're finding this one fix, point two, which is challenging and understanding what your pre-existing biases or conditioning is. And by that, I mean, like I said at the beginning, you know, when I went to MNU, like, what were my pre-existing biases? Well, you know, the plant-based diet is obviously the healthiest diet, and therefore we must have, that must be best for optimal performance. Well, that's not necessarily right. And we can see the negative effect of a high level of pre-existing bias, because we can see these thrown at us on a larger scale. Netflix, Game Changers, a masterclass in how to project bias onto people without really diving into contrarian analysis, and then putting up a bunch of studies on the screen. And I'm the sort of person that paused, found the study, read it, and understood the fact that actually there was a lot of stuff on there that was just cherry-picked from that data, thrown up onto screen because you're probably not going to go and look at the research. And then we're looking at confirmation bias. You know, we are pushing biases onto people. And then you've got your conditioning. The reason I said conditioning is understanding what is the conditioning that your life has had on you up to this point. For example, I'm 30 years old. So if I look back at my parents' generation, my mum, when I was a kid, she'd be on SlimFast. Fats were bad. Fats were demonized back in that day. You know, we're still in the point where carbs are bad. We're still at the point where, you know, my dad would have the big plate of food and my mum would have the small plate of food. And I was talking to my girlfriend the other day about this exact same thing. And her culture of understanding was, you know, she had been conditioned to have the small dish of food as well. And that went into her adulthood. So, and how that then impacted her as a professional mountain bike racer. We've got a large amount of conditioning on a very big, complex chessboard in front of us. And it's very much understanding that these things do exist and being open-minded enough to take on some contrarian information, look at it critically, and not fall into a, you know, this is the one fix for me. And equally, I think when it comes to other diet and pitfalls, just focusing on food is one of them. Absolutely. You know, nutrition is one thing, but if we're trying to improve our health, which we all probably are, or we're trying to, you know, address certain things in our health, well, food is one part of this complex jigsaw puzzle. Exercise is another part. Psychological health is another part. Financial health is another part. Environmental health is another part. You know, our intimate health, our relationships at work, our space at home, all of these things, our sleep, everything else is going to be impacting what you decide to put in your mouth and how you decide to move your body. So just focusing on food is very much a common diet trap, because you can have the best diet in the world, but if you are mega stressed out, if you are in maybe a negative relationship, or the people around you, you know, it's relatively negative relationships around you, you don't like being at work, you hate the commute, you know, you're generally dissatisfied, you're not exercising, you can have the best diet in the world, but all of that work will be undone. And I feel like the last one here is, like I said before about there not being good or bad foods, is demonizing foods. Putting sins on foods, for example, which is a completely made up system that doesn't work for anybody. You know, having such a psychological reaction to foods that is bad. I've had a few clients now who I've worked with, and it's been an interesting journey, because when we first started, I was saying, like, talk to me about your understanding of nutrition. I'm like, you know, what do you think is good? What do you think is bad? Like, where are we at? Like, oh, I don't eat bread. I don't eat dairy. I hate eating, you know, carbs. You know, okay, well, can we just just define carbs. Just want to get some perspective, like define carbs. Oh, well, like, you know, cake and chips and burgers. And you're like, large majority of that is going to be, you know, like overly processed fats and, you know, not necessarily carbs as a whole, because in those carbs, we're not looking at, you know, beans and whole grains and maybe whole grain bread and all that sort of thing. So demonizing foods, I feel like, is setting ourselves up for failure, because it's feeding biases. It's making us just focus on the good and the bad foods, and it's leaving us to find that one fix which just fits that bias. And if you're consistently in that cycle, it's a negative feedback loop, because you'll never find the answer.
I think that's fascinating for a number of reasons, actually, Ben. But like you said, because the heuristics that we apply, and also the broad spectrum of foods, but very much to that point around having different elements of your life bleed in, because I think and men can be guilty of this. I certainly can. Whereas you think you can segment your life, and actually, what you find is you can't segment. You can't shut off different areas. They all bleed into each other. You know, a lack of sleep bleeds into eating habits, bleeds into exercise habits, bleeds into your attention. And there's lots of crossover, and we aren't siloed within our lives. Everything is in a constant state of flux and interplay. Could I get you to speak to your diet in the military and on exercise? I was going to actually ask you about your strategy for long distance running as well. So I guess the military is an analog of a lot of long distance events, because there's, just by the procedure of being engaged within military activity, there's a semblance of long distance running or exercise or activity. Could you, as an extension of your reflection on your sort of your diet in the military and on exercise, could you maybe speak to the ultramarathons with a 25 kilogram rucksack? Because that might be quite the analog to what you were probably used to in the military.
So that's really interesting. And the reason I've got a big smile on my face is because my nutrition on exercise, I mean, nutrition on exercise is awful. I mean, goodness me. You know, we got fried Spam and packet mashed potato from the 10-man ration packs, you know, and if we're on American camps, you've got grits and you've just got generally pretty poor food. But at the end of the day, you're in the army, you're on exercise, you just eat what you're given, right? And I would just eat mass. And, you know, in hindsight, okay, I was making the best of what we had in terms of ensuring we're eating enough. Definitely didn't eat enough on exercise. And I feel like that's a really standard thing. You know, when you look at the amount of calories in a ration pack, well, that's including all of the liquid calories, that's including all the energy drinks, that's including every single aspect of the ration pack. And any single person who's ever been in the army and gone through those 10-man ration packs will get their own single 24 hours and they'll go through everything. No one will eat everything. I've never known anyone eat everything. You know, they'll pick the bits out and they'll be like, oh, yeah, I'll have those. I'll have the biscuits, I'll have the tuna, or I'll have the hot chocolate, or I'll have the, you know, the pastry and sauce, and I'll have the whatevers. And then they leave the rest of it because, you know, A, you don't want to carry the weight, and B, it's just a waste of space. So nutrition on exercise, pretty poor. You know, it's functional. You're doing what you can, but you are definitely malnourished. And on my training, like training exercises before deployment and stuff like that, you know, they were big exercises and we were out for a very long time. And I do distinctly remember being on the bus coming back from Stanta training area, get on the M25, stop up at McDonald's, Burger King services somewhere on the M25, ready for a very long sleep on the back of the bus. But beforehand, I would have a Burger King XL bacon double cheeseburger supersized meal with a side of an XL bacon double cheeseburger supersized meal. I would legit eat that, smash it both, 2 liters of Coke, no problem at all, go to sleep, rinse and repeat, do it all tomorrow. And it is the soldier's diet, isn't it? Of how many times have I been on a PFA and, you know, lined up for the count before your 1.5 mile run. I don't know if they still do that nowadays, but the 1.5 mile run, and you just have the smell of beer, you know, because we're soldiers and that's what soldiers did. I mean, I wasn't a massive drinker, but you would definitely see that. And I do feel like in hindsight, like looking back on this, if there was more support, education, and facilitation of better nutrition around exercise, and not just deployable exercise, you know, going to like training areas, but also training exercise, i.e. in the gym, your daily phys and the rest of it, then I feel like you'd have a much healthier population in the army. Now, don't get me wrong, it's a bit like telling students not to drink. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to have people just not drinking, but you might have people looking after themselves after exercise a little bit more. Now, I took that on a bit of a journey because I feel like I was relatively healthy, notwithstanding the supersized meals from Burger King. But on the generally on the whole, you know, there would be a lot of vegetables and salads and decent proteins. You know, as soon as Pay As You Dine came in, I cooked a lot in the block, much to the dismay of my queue man. I would hide pretty much an entire kitchen in my wardrobe and then cook in the room and stuff. And, you know, had a decent bit of food. And that was fed by things I was reading and different books and stuff along the way, you know, playing into doing things like the ultramarathons. And quite frankly, the whole point of doing the ultramarathons was when I was in the army, I spent 3 years trying to join the SAS. So I had 3 attempts at selection, none of which was successful. I will throw that out there. But I realized that I need to start looking after myself. I needed to start distancing myself from my current unit because I really didn't enjoy what I was doing at the time. And I needed to start, you know, getting some big training in. So I needed to do some big days in the hills. So what better way than just to enter a race? And I wrote to them and said, look, I'm definitely going to be last. I need to carry this burden. It's got all of my safety stuff in for 24 hours. I'm completely self-sufficient, so there's nothing really to worry about. But it'd be really great to have the safety of a tracker. And they were like, oh, yeah, cool, turn on up. So I did this Dartmoor ultramarathon, which was a 50K to start off with. And I was like, oh, this is great. Put my Bergen on, took my 2 Huskies, off we went. Had a really, really long day. It was amazing. And got to the end, and they were like, cool, you come into the next one on a joke, which was in like a couple of months' time in Exmoor, funny enough. And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And then after that, they were like, you don't need to pay anymore. Just come on up, because it was great. And by the 5th one, like, I wasn't coming last. Like, I remember overtaking people. And, you know, I realized that my fitness was improving. So I needed to, like, work on my recovery and other bits and pieces. And, you know, my recovery was still going to Nando's, eating chicken, because chicken is protein and protein was good. That was kind of my understanding. I had all the supplements in the world. So I was taking, like, tons of pre-workout and stuff that largely now, with my knowledge now, is largely unnecessary. But it was very much a baptism of fire, which I feel like gives me a bit of an edge when it comes to, you know, coaching people in the nutrition world now, because I've made an awful lot of mistakes. I've learned an awful lot. I've run multiple marathons back to back on Mexican food and eaten far too much and seen it all again. You know, I've made the mistakes on how to overfuel, underfuel, eat the right things, not eat the right things, try a plant-based diet, try full carbs, try loads of gels, try loads of fats, taken it to the high altitude mountains and tried to figure out the right and wrong things to do, which I'm sure we'll dive into later on. But ultimately, there has to be that sort of playfulness in how you approach nutrition and trialing things. Like I said, you know, number one diet trap, there's no one fix here for endurance fuel. You might be like Beth Pascal, who is an absolute machine at endurance running and cycling, and she quite openly is gels through and through. You could be like Damien Hall, equally a machine in the endurance world, like an absolute monster of a runner on a vegan Whole Foods approach to his fueling. You know, he'll sit and eat a hummus sandwich on the side of a run, you know, or avocado bagels and stuff like that, olives, things like that. You know, he absolutely swears by. And then I kind of learned from that, being like, okay, well, there is no right or wrong answer here. We just need to figure out what works. And as Ross Edgley would say, you know, when he was training for swimming all the way around Great Britain, training your digestive system is one of the key things when it comes to doing anything long distance. And by long distance, it could be a 50K ultra, it could be a 17-day expedition, whatever. You know, training your digestive system to understand that, you know, there's going to be days where I'm running hungry or cycling hungry, you know, insert your discipline here. There are days where I'm going to be running full. There are days where I would purposely have a relatively large breakfast and then run about an hour later for a very long day out. Again, train that digestive system. You're eating on the run, you're training and trialing all these different things to figure out what works for you. And what we'll come on to later in terms of like top tips, like one that I want to refer back to is keeping a training diary, but also having a nutrition section in that training diary. Like, it's great to know your sets and your reps and your times and stuff, but like, what did you eat beforehand? What worked? Your pre-long run food nutrition strategy, what was that? Did it work? Did it not work? Like, what's the feedback? Did you feel hungry within a couple of hours? Did you have that like awful, well, not necessarily awful, but like that very obvious feeling of like an empty, hollow stomach, and you felt the sloshing around of liquid, and you can also hear it? Like, it's a very strange thing, but you know, you've got a little bit of bloating going on there. There might be a little bit of IBS going on there. Like, what's working, what's not working, and treating yourself like a science experiment. That is exactly what I did going through all of these different challenges. And I royally screwed up on some of them, but those are pure lessons. And I feel like to take those ultramarathons and then go one step further to the Three Peaks rope climb. That's the masterclass on how to get things wrong. I actually had a sponsorship at that point from a supplement company. Now, the Three Peaks rope climb was a challenge that I just made up. I was going to climb a 20-foot gym rope 731 times to reach the height of Ben Nevis, Scarfell, and Snowdon consecutively, and I wanted to do it all in 12 hours. Ross Edgley was helping me with the training and the logistics and bits and pieces because he held the world's longest rope climb record because he climbed the height of Everest. And I was like, I'm going to go for second place and I'll do the Three Peaks rope climb, which was roughly 50% of what he did. So I thought 50% of the time seems like a good idea. Got this supplement company on board. You know, they gave me a nutritionist from their team. And it was like, right, you need this cocktail of different supplements. And I had pre-workouts, I had creatines, I had beta-alanine, I had protein shakes, had meal replacement shakes. Goodness me, I had so many shakes, bars, sweet things, everything. And I got to 400 reps, and goodness me, the next 100 were so hard. And breaking 500 was even to this day, like just one of the worst things I've done. Because I was getting to the top and just letting go of this rope and dropping down onto the crash mats, standing up, going again. I was so tired. And I finally got to 500 and I slumped on the edge of this mat because I bought in my head, I negotiated I was going to have a rest at that point. And Fiona, who worked at the Ice Factor at the time, the indoor climbing wall that I used for the rope climb, she sort of grabbed me by the head and she lifted me up and said, Ben, what do you need? And I was like, cheese and ham toasty, cheesy chips with ketchup. Specifically, I want a salted caramel fridge milkshake from the co-op. I want some granola bars and some ice cream and kettle chips. Those specific things. And she was like, right. And bless her, this hero of a human being came back with all of those things. And bear in mind, my arms were dead. Like lots of my body was dead at this point. And I'm just sat on the floor, just like devouring this stuff like an animal. And then I was fine. And the next 230 odd just bashed them out and felt good and felt strong. Had a pint of Guinness at the end and decently, genuinely felt good. And I was like, well, clearly going for the, you know, 100% supplement brand and kind of getting that investment didn't work for me. So that was an absolute masterclass of an after action review to figure out, well, what worked, what didn't work. Why did the salty food work? Why was it cheesy chips? Why did I specifically want, you know, that sweet milkshake? Well, clearly I needed something sweet. I needed something salty. I needed some carbs. I needed some protein. I needed some actual food, maybe a little bit of fiber in there as well, because I was so sick of very, very sweet pre-workouts and very, very awful protein shakes that I just wasn't eating anything. So an absolute masterclass for me personally in figuring out how not to do things so I could learn how to do things in the future. That's a roundabout, very long-winded way of answering your question.
I think it's really intuitive, but I think to your point, Ben, I think you almost have to put yourself in these situations to understand through trial and error what does work for you and indeed what your body needs at that time. I very much did a 120 kilometer of ultramarathon from east coast to west coast of the UK and Carlisle to Newcastle, and tuna sandwiches and Haribo. I had no tolerance for gels but could take the dextrose tablets quite easily, but again, trial and error, like you said, and actually having tangible digestive food and maybe complex carbs, which your body can actually get hold of over time, rather than just this, the consumable or the almost processed food, which was an offer. So just looking at the reframing about macro and micronutrients, is this a helpful terminology? Is it helpful to break diet and or foods down into sort of macro and micronutrients?
So I think, you know, for the audience, macronutrients are your protein, fats and carbohydrates. Micronutrients are your vitamins and minerals. If you are looking at your overall approach to diet, outside of endurance adventures, for your overall diet, it is useful to understand what macro and micronutrients are and where we get them from. We do not need to put huge emphasis for daily nutrition. We don't need to put huge emphasis on the different breakdown of like your fats and your micro and your carbs and your fats, protein, sorry. A lot of people would be like, hey man, what's your macro split? And quite frankly, nobody cares. But when it comes to your overall health, you know, focusing on protein, very, very good. Does protein need to be in every single thing you eat? No, it doesn't. Does it get massively overstated by influencers on the social media? You're damn right it does. But what are the benefits of each of these? Well, each of the three of these macronutrients are essential in one form or another in our diet. You know, carbohydrates are essential for an instant hit of fuel. The brain feeds off sugar. We need that in our diet and in our bodies. Fats essential for hormonal health, for the utilization of fat-soluble vitamins, you know, essential stuff. Protein, every single cell in the human body, receptor of protein. We know that protein is good news. So having that understanding and having that background knowledge means that you can shape your own nutrition strategy. So if you are looking at, you know, we can look at the intricacies. If we're looking at weight loss, for example, well, protein's more satiating, fiber's more satiating, makes us feel full for longer. So maybe we can increase that. And then we can let the fats and the carbs just kind of sort themselves out. We can make more healthful choices. But if you're more preferential to a higher fat diet than a higher carb diet, then you can let those sort themselves out. If I woke you up in the morning with breakfast, how unpleasant would that be? Well, if I could give you a bowl of porridge or avocado and poached eggs on, you know, rye bread, which one would you prefer? Well, one is relatively high carb, one is relatively high fat. You know, it, depending on what your preferences are, then the carbs and fats will sort themselves out. When it comes to micronutrients, yes, okay, we can dive into the weeds of it. You can get a blood test and start to see what your full panel of vitamins and minerals are. But ultimately, for the general people who are looking to improve their overall health, if you are getting plenty of fruits and vegetables, and as insultingly simple as it sounds, you know, that five a day, if you're getting variety in your diet, you're probably getting enough of your micronutrients. You know, if you're looking at an entirely plant-based diet, then maybe things like, you know, vitamin B12 and other bits and pieces are going to be more beneficial. Then we can look at like supplementation. For the majority of us in the UK, you know, we want to be looking at vitamin D supplementation. We want to be looking at omega-3 fatty acids. We want to be looking at bits and pieces like that. You can use a multivitamin as like an insurance policy if you really want to, but we don't need to be putting tons and tons of emphasis on it. Look at that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Well, the absolute base is going to be energy intake. How much do we actually need for the goal that we're trying to achieve? And that's energy intake plus habits, the big ugly H word. Because understanding what our habits are around that food, the next step up is our macronutrients and our fiber. So understanding, you know, vitamins, minerals, fats, carbs, protein, fiber. Understanding how that makes up, that's the bricks of the house, if everything else is the foundation and the concrete. So let's figure out the bricks. And then we can then work forward from there. If we're looking at sporting performance, then looking at macro splits per se are a little bit more important. So for example, if we have on one side somebody who is, I was training earlier this year and last year for a 230-mile run through the Scottish Highlands. Well, if I'm going to be doing that over 72 hours, my macro split's going to be very different to somebody who is going for the Kona Ironman World Champs. So the latter, this person, let's call this person Dave, who's going for the Kona Ironman World Champs. Even if it's not world champs, you're just going for a very, very long day out of lots of relatively high intensity exercise. It's a really tough day out, especially for those who are really pushing it. You're going to be on, you know, 70 to 75% carbohydrates on that day because you need instant fuel to just keep pushing and pushing. Me, on the other hand, well, if I'm looking at running for 72 hours, I don't think I can eat that much carbs for 72 hours. Like my digestive system would just turn itself inside out. And I don't need carbs for that particular speed and intensity because the speed is relatively low and the intensity is relatively low. It's just a bloody long time. So I can then start to look at more of a whole foods approach, get some interest into my diet, increase the fat intake so I can increase my fat adaptation, utilizing fat as fuel. Whereas somebody who is going for like hard, aggressive exercise is going to need to use carbohydrates as fuel. It's a bit like if you're a car that can run off petrol and diesel. Well, we all know that petrol cars are faster than diesel cars, right? On the instant acceleration. Well, if petrol in this sense is the carbohydrates and diesel in this sense is the fats, and you're a car that runs off both and you've got two tanks. Well, when you go from stationary on the M6 services at T-Bay and you pull out of the services to go up to 70 miles an hour on the motorway, you have to go through a series of gears. And if that car is using both of these tanks of fuel, you're going to be using predominantly petrol as you're revving up, changing gear, bringing up to speed before you can click on cruise control. When you get to 70 miles an hour and you flick on cruise control, the intensity of the engine drops down a wee bit. It evens out. We're not pushing the accelerator as much. Therefore, we can start to use diesel or fat in this sense as our fuel for that longer term process. So when we look at that, it's very much down to what is the stimulus that we're looking to fuel? What's the event? What's the adventure? What are we trying to achieve here? And that's going to help dictate what that macro split is. And then to round off your answer, when we look at the micronutrients of it, well, if we're putting our body through a lot of stress, through a lot of training and a lot of development, if we're doing an Ironman, if we're doing a 230-mile run, if we're going to the high altitude mountains or whatever it is that we're doing, then yes, we need to make sure that we are getting adequate micronutrients in there as well. Because one thing that does slip up, which we'll come on to in a second, I'm sure, one thing that does slip up is variety and vitamins intake when it comes to lots of packaged food. You're going on a big expedition, you're going to want long life food. Well, long life food is notoriously low in things like vitamin C, for example, which we've learned from Arctic and Antarctic expeditions. So we need to start looking at how we can adapt that. So, you know, we can start to balance those micronutrients. But again, it's very much down to what is the stimulus that we're looking to train at, that we're looking to develop for, and what are the exact requirements of that? Because that's when it becomes a bit more of an exact science. You know, every single thing that we're going to implement is going to have a larger output for that given stimulus.
So to your point, actually, Ben, around nutrition isn't just about the food. It's also about the hydration and about the electrolytes, and indeed making sure your hydration strategy is as equally informed as your nutritional one. Could you speak to hydration and electrolytes consumption?
So we know that hydration is essential. We know that if we sweat, it tastes salty, so we're losing electrolytes. Now, electrolytes aren't just sodium. You know, we've got sodium, we've got potassium, we've got chloride, you've got magnesium, you've got calcium, you've got phosphate, and you've also got bicarbonates as well. So those all make up our electrolytes, and we lose them when we excrete them out. We can pee them out, we can sweat them out. So we need to ensure that we are adequately hydrating for everyday health. You know, getting anywhere between 2 and 3 liters of water per day, winner. If you get the majority of that liquid from water, equally as a winner. You know, drinking 3 liters of coffee per day, you're definitely going to know about it. But, you know, getting adequate hydration in your daily life, very, very good news. When it comes to our endurance, when it comes to our longer term adventures, or quite frankly, any training, we need to ensure that, again, we are addressing the stimulus. If it's hot and we're doing aggressive training, we're going to sweat lots. If you're doing endurance training, you're going to sweat lots regardless of the climate. So we need to ensure that there's a balance of electrolytes here. We need to ensure that we are adequately refueling. I'm going to use the term refueling, that given training load. Now, the golden question is, exactly how much do we need? Now, there are a couple of things we can do. You can do things like sweat tests, where you understand, you know, exactly how much liquid you're losing, and you can kind of compare body weights before and after training and things like that, figure out your sweat loss rate and other bits and pieces, and then rehydrate to that more exact science, which a lot of Ironman triathletes do or endurance athletes will do. Or you can look at the work of Professor Tim Noakes, who has done some really interesting stuff in dehydration and basically comes up with the rather underwhelming conclusion of drinking to thirst. Now, I feel like drinking to thirst has pretty much become a bit too gospel in the world. People just use that a little bit too much, and there's going to be a detrimental impact to that, to people who maybe aren't particularly thirsty and aren't drinking that much, and then therefore dehydrated, or maybe feeling that they're more thirsty than they actually are, and then overhydrating. So there's a plus and a minus to that argument. For the large majority of people, drinking to thirst is good. Depending on the training stimulus is then how much of an electrolyte rehydration do we need. So, you know, yes, we can rehydrate with just water. But if we look at a rehydration scale, if this is a bar graph, if water has a rehydration level of 1, then we can look at like a Lucozade sports drink, for example, which is going to have a much, much, much higher rehydration score because it's got electrolytes in it. Funnily enough, things like whole milk has a much higher rehydration score than water because of the other bits and pieces in it, the electrolytes and the protein and bits and pieces that are in that. You know, even Coca-Cola, things like that, because there's glucose and to an extent some electrolytes in some of these drinks as well, that's going to help with the uptake of rehydration. So we need to ensure that, A, we understand the impact of dehydration, you know, the cognitive decline, the performance, the health markers, liver and kidney health, the rest of it, and then understand, well, what's the stimulus we're training for? And how do we best find out our balance of rehydrating? And that can be drinking to thirst, depending on the level of training that you're doing, or it can be doing things like sweat loss tests and understanding the a bit more of a mathematical equation to it.
That makes absolute sense, actually. And understanding the physiological demands on the body from the actual event that you'll be undertaking makes sense. Ben, I wonder if you could pivot and look at expedition and indeed prolonged and or short expeditions, to your earlier point about catering for the foundations of good nutrition on expedition. Could you speak to the preferable foods that you would be looking to consume on expedition from a foundational perspective? And indeed, like you said before, keeping it simple.
100%. Well, the first thing is looking at duration and logistics. So I've been on expeditions where, funnily enough, I've been put in charge of the logistics and the food. I might have got this wrong a couple of times, unfortunately. Sorry to that team. And we went off to some far-flung parts of the world. And you want to be looking at the duration and the logistics. How long are you out for? How easy is it to get that food out there? Are you carrying it all yourself? Let's look at an Antarctic expedition. And we've all read the books on Antarctic expeditions of people like Ranulf Fiennes and Mike Stroud when they're crossing Antarctica just eating butter, for example. Like, well, that works in the duration and logistics. You're going super fat adapted. Their bodies went to quite literally 0% body fat, which people genuinely thought was impossible at the time. They should have been dead, but they fueled themselves for that long. Clearly, we don't want to be pushing ourselves to that position. However, there are things that we need to consider here. So when I've been off to expeditions to the Himalayas, for example, we knew that we could have all of our food put in barrels and flown out, no problem. Then we had to carry it all ourselves. Maybe you've got Sherpas and things that are going to carry all of your stuff for you. Or maybe you're doing it Alpine style, where you pack everything on your back and you're cracking on and you're doing like longer distances, maybe over a couple of days, 2 to 3 days perhaps, and everything's on your back. So again, we want to be looking at, are we looking freeze-dried? Do we look specifically at a calorie target? Or do we look at, okay, well, what's the workload? Is it going to be, you know, 8-hour days, 12-hour days on the mountain, for example? So we need to then look at, well, what are we going to be requiring to be able to eat every hour or every 2 hours, for example? On the whole, there are some studies that will allude to having 2.2 to 2.4 times your BMR as a daily intake of calories recommended for altitude and sort of more extreme environments as a bit of a ballpark figure for where you're at. So there are a couple of people who are, you know, cutting around across Antarctica and doing really, really cool things, who will be eating tons of like trail mixes type food and, you know, butter type food, because they are maximum calories for minimum space. Yes, there's going to be a weight quotient there as well. You know, having a lot of peanut butter is certainly going to weigh you down. But again, for the calorie concentration of those sort of things, they're going to be more beneficial to what it is that we're trying to what we're trying to carry. But ultimately, and this is where I've got it wrong before in the past, you want to make it easy to eat. Same with any race nutrition. Making something easy to eat that you have practiced is crucial. You know, we've had expeditions where we've gone out with Huel shakes, and, you know, people have really not thanked me for what I thought was great, because I was bagging this big deal with this big company, and it was awful. Like, the shakes were awful, the bars were awful, and nobody thanked me for it at all. In another barrel, I got a bunch of stuff from Tesco's, and we had, like, you know, baby bells, and we had fruit bars, and we had like cereal bars and peanut butters and stuff like that, which were fantastic to eat and really, really, really worked well. So you want to ensure that there is, first and foremost, understand the duration and the logistics. Like, what's the ins and outs of the expedition? Are we carrying everything, or can we get some help? Are we then going to look at things that are easy to eat? If we're looking at things that are easy to eat, we need to make sure that we have enough. So again, looking at what is the exertion of that particular expedition? Are you trekking for a few days, in which case the exertion is probably not going to be that bad, and therefore you're probably not going to need that much? Or is it pretty full on? You know, you're towing pulks and stuff across Antarctica, for example, where you're going to be burning tons and tons and tons of calories, you know, potentially 10,000 calories a day here, you know, and then how you then look at refueling that in line with the duration, the logistics, the weight and everything else. Yes, you can go down the line of looking at fat adaptation versus looking at high carb stuff. Ultimately, it entirely depends on the stimulus that you're training for. Yes, you can achieve fat adaptation. when it comes to sort of fattening up for expeditions, there is definitely a fine line between the detriment of fattening up and then being heavier, especially if you're looking at mountain expeditions, versus, you know, people who are crossing Antarctica where the weight isn't that much of an issue. So, you know, fattening up gives you a nice big bank of calories that you can burn on your person. And then looking at the high carb side of life, well, you know, if you're an Ironman triathlete, the high carb side of life is essential. If you're trekking for 21 days across the Himalayas, well, you don't want to be eating a high carb diet for 21 days. A, you've got to carry all that stuff, and B, you're going to get sick of eating it all. So then we can look at the fat adaptation just to make our life as easy as possible. So there's an awful lot of nuance when it comes to expedition foods. It's entirely dependent on the expedition itself, but factors to consider are, you know, duration, logistics, how much you're going to need based on the expectation of load and exertion, making things easy to eat, and then understanding the ins and outs of that. You know, are we going to be looking at more fat adaptation, or are we going to look at more of a high carb concentration?
So, Ben, as we start to come into land on the conversation, if we could just maybe get you to speak to some of the takeaways for listeners that they could institute within their regimes. Just again, some of the generic principles and or top tips from yourself.
I think first and foremost, understand the goal. Understand what it is that you're trying to achieve first and foremost. It sounds insultingly simple, I know. But are you training for expeditions and also trying to lose weight and also trying to boost performance and also trying to live healthfully? Or are you trying to just do one thing? Because if you need to lose weight, go lose weight. Do that first. Come back and then look at sports performance. Well, once you've got sports performance, then look at your expedition. If you're going on an expedition in 6 weeks' time, great. Let's dial that in first, because there's no point looking to lose weight before that. We need to be fueling the effort that's required. So understand the goal, break it down from there. Then train your digestive system. So practice on your longer training sessions. If it's a long bike ride, a long hike, a long run, a long whatever, you know, train your digestive system so it is expecting food and fueling during training, especially for long distance things, multi-day things. Because the last thing you want is to get out and be doing something that's big and multi-day and your gut's not used to eating and moving, because that it's going to come out one end or the other and it's not going to be pretty. Training diary. Maintain a training diary, not just for your training, but also for your nutrition. That is going to be absolute gold dust, not for you, not just for you at the time, but once you've done that expedition and you're looking back on it. So when I was cycling around Iceland for 28 days, I covered 3,500 kilometers. Like when I was doing all of my, I did a training diary. I did a sort of an adventure diary as the way through, you know, some thoughts for the day and how howling some of the hills were, but also what I was eating. It was Iceland. It was super expensive. So I wasn't eating that much. So I was writing it all down and I can look back at it and it's gold dust for understanding the bigger picture of how to do these things, you know, for a future reattempt or something similar. And again, trial before execution. So understanding, practice, understanding, doing everything you can to practice the stimulus, practice the fueling, practice all of your strategies and tear them all apart. You're looking for failure in these strategies so that you can pick holes in it before then you go to the execution. It's a bit like blindly going into a sales meeting at work, right? You want to make sure that your sales pitch is bomb-proof so that when you do go into it and you can deliver, boof, you can then deliver the goods and you are good to go. So exactly the same thing when it comes to our nutrition, to use another analogy to round things off.
That's fantastic, because it speaks to that really, that first order, second order, and third order mindset around truly understanding the expedition, the planning, the execution, the demands and the terrain, and indeed just having that holistic perspective, hopefully from and sharing that amongst the team prior to going on an expedition, because like you said, expectation setting and indeed realigning expectations is a prerequisite which people need to appreciate as well, so that they're fully prepared and there is this shared mental model in place. But Ben, just as we finish off, could I just get to speak to where people would find you online if they want to reach out to you?
So I feel like social media, I try and do a good job on social media, but I'm pretty useless. So I feel like Instagram or Facebook, either Ben Turner Coach or just Ben Turner. It's usually any of the profile pictures that has orange in the background. That seems to be my color of choice at the moment. That is the main area that you can find me, or go onto my website, which I'm currently redesigning at the moment. So hopefully by the time listeners can go and have a look at it, it looks a little bit better, which is indefit.com, which is INDE-fit.com. And that's where all the details of me can be found, but mostly Instagram. But again, folks, if you've got any questions or anything that you feel has been unanswered, because I feel like a lot of the answers have been relatively nebula because they do have a lot of nuance and context. If there are any questions, just reach out, ask me a question. You know, I'm always happy to help as much as I possibly can to ensure that people have got all the information they need.
That's fantastic, Ben. And we'll signpost to your details on the show notes just so people can indeed reach out and ask you those questions. Because like you said, we can't do it justice in an hour. This is a massive topic and requires a lot of multimodal learning. So we certainly do that. Ben, thank you for your time today.
You're most welcome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.